Hi, everybody. Okay,
welcome to California.
Thank you. I'm happy to be in California. So I'm happy also to be asked to do this talk. This seems like I'm at the process. I've only been here 3 months. And so this has been a great opportunity for me to meet different groups, learn about potential collaborators, have people get a sense of who I am. So it's really a sense now that even if, you know, transplantation isn't your thing or education isn't your thing, I think what's great is we can all learn about each other. And I need some friends. I would like to respectfully request some friends, please, out of this meeting. Okay, but I have to drive the thing and it doesn't drive.
You have a Facebook
I do. Please feel free to Facebook me. It doesn't drive.
It's not going forward?
No. Maybe I go right. Okay, yeah. Right. This is where I live. On the 12th floor in suite 1223. We've only had 3 people ever visit us in the whole time I've been here, 3 months. That's why I'm showing you where I live, just in case you want to visit. But I also wanted to talk about kind of what I want to get to today. I'm actually going to talk about a lot of things in a big, broad brushstroke, so it's going to be a lot of information. But I want to introduce my team and the approach in which I conduct research. I want to assess why deceased and living donor transplants aren't always occurring. I want to evaluate the effectiveness of Explore Transplant on helping dialysis providers become motivated to educate their own patients. So can you educate providers to do better education? I want to discuss how improved transplant education may help more African American patients learn more and receive living donor transplants. And I want to discuss the possibilities for a center of transplant education and living donation. So me, I'm a social and health psychologist. I used to be a faculty member at Washington University School of Medicine and in the Health Services Research Division for 12 years. I have since been hired by nephrology, and I'm working there and happy to be part of UCLA. I was the quality manager of Barnes Jewish Transplant Center. So I also have an interesting experience where as a social and health psychologist, normally you're outside of the clinical care process. But I was intimately involved with the process because we were running data and things like that. I also founded a nonprofit corporation dealing with transplant education. And I want to start and talk about the ladder metaphor a little bit. So we always talk about research as an academic ladder. It's a rigorous climb. What Amy produces is the key thing. Others are competing against me. There's one way to success, and that is up. There's one leader. It's both precarious, and so if I screw up, it falls down, and it's a fixed thing about what to do to succeed. Well, my belief at this point, having done this a while, is actually research would be better modeled as a jungle gym. Sheryl Sandberg agrees with me. I stole this from her, so she gets the credit. But what I want to say is she believes your whole career should be a jungle gym. My feeling with research, it's definitely apropos. I think the first part is that as stressful as research is, I think we need to have a metaphor where we are climbing a jungle gym as play and the fun of research, not the competitive viciousness of research. I think it's about what we produce, our whole teams, our collaborations. We can be collaborative with each other. I also think from a jungle gym is that there are multiple paths to success. It does not have to look like straight up and out. It can look any different way. You can move sideways for a while. I'm sure we all know that. I also think this is a more stable structure, and it allows for creativity. So this is really where I come from as a researcher. And I have a lot of people on my jungle gym. So I have some grant funding. I have multiple million dollars of grant funding from the NIH, HRSA, and the One Legacy Foundation. I have an amazing research team both here and in Missouri still, because one of our grants is in Missouri. I want my team back here to raise your hand. Here they all are. They come to see what I do. I also feel that having a powerful advisory board of leaders across the country is critical. So I actually have partners that are working in dialysis, transplant centers, organ procurement organizations, patients, and donors. I'm also working actively on projects from many different places, many different transplant centers to allow me access to different sizes and types of transplant patients. I'm working in policy with Tim McBride. I'm working, Keith and I began our collaboration once I joined, which I'm really excited by, and we have multiple people with expertise in the trans-theoretical model at the University of Rhode Island. So again, a national jungle gym, not just UCLA. So why transplant? Who cares? How did I pick this, or how did it pick me? So one of the things that I feel is transplant is the best of humanity and the best of healthcare. When transplant works, it's amazing that somebody who dies that's charitable, who says, if my organs could be used for other people, I'd like them to be, that they donate. It's also somebody that sees their loved one in need or their friend in need or even a stranger that they don't know and wants to do a greater good. So to see that every day as a transplant person is incredibly inspiring. The other part that's also inspiring is to watch the surgeons do what they do. The idea that you could take an organ kidney out of me from the back, sew it into somebody else in the front right here, and that their life could increase between 7 and 15 additional years is a pretty amazing thing that our healthcare system can do. So I love being part of that line of watching people making decisions, being scared, having it work, sometimes having it not work, and seeing how I can help. The other part I get is there are a lot of problems that we can chip at as researchers and as people who plan interventions. This is one we could actually significantly reduce, and I'd actually like to posit that we could solve it. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that there are about 100,000 people who need a kidney transplant right now. So as a person planning interventions, that doesn't seem to me to be 50 million people. It's 100,000 people, right? And if everybody could be living donors, there's actually a solution too. So it's an interesting area to think about. And then finally, I'm not trained as a physician. And as a social psychologist, I can improve health and sustain lives through the work that I do every day. So it's really an honor to be in this space. What I do is develop, assess the effectiveness of, and nationally disseminate patient and provider education that improves informed transplant and living donation decision-making, care, and outcomes. My passion is to reduce racial disparities in access to transplant and living donation, and to increase living donation rates. And ultimately, in the secret part that you put at the end of all your grant applications, the goal would be that we could solve the shortage of donated organs. So let me set this up for you, just in case you don't know a lot about transplant. So when a person has kidney failure, their kidneys stop working. Sometimes they don't even urinate anymore. So imagine the drink that we drink right here. You now can't get rid of it. You start to swell. This put pressure on your heart, all these things. There are a lot of things that go wrong when your kidneys don't work. So the idea is we have to help people without functioning kidneys live by either putting them on some type of dialysis to filter their blood and get rid of all of the poisons, or to give them the option of getting a transplant from someone else. Now, the most common type of treatment for kidney failure is going on dialysis. So there's almost 600,000 patients with kidney failure. 70% of them are on dialysis. However, there's only 100,000 candidates on the transplant waiting list. So the question is, okay, why did they go on dialysis? Wouldn't it be better to get a transplant? Did anything happen? So the other part that concerns me is that dialysis patients of color are less likely to be referred for transplant evaluation and to receive deceased or living donor transplants. So you can kind of see that both everyone's headed into dialysis. Yeah.
How many people are living with transplants roughly?
Right now, there are about 15,000 that get a transplant every year. And then they live as long as they live. So they've been doing this since 1965. So we could do the math to see how many that is, right?
But some of the transplants fail.
Some of them fail, yes.
So did these 594 include people who have, these are just people who did not have transplants?
These are everybody, including the people with transplants. So 30% of the people have a transplant, right? Yep. So here's a question that I have. If dialysis is the most common treatment, are dialysis patients who are not pursuing transplant uninterested or unaware of the option of transplant? Okay. Now, if you wanted to get a transplant, so right now you all do not have kidney function. Okay, you have to stop eating and drinking at this time. Now, the key is how would we get you to transplant? We would start and we would tell you that you could get a transplant. We'd have you call to begin evaluation. You would mail a medical packet saying you wanted to be evaluated. You'd attend transplant medical appointments. You'd get listed for transplant. You'd complete a yearly reevaluation until your number came up on the deceased donor list. You would look out in your community for a living donor. And then finally, you'd receive a deceased or living donor transplant. The process from the beginning to the end of this in California can be over 10 years, even more if you don't learn about transplant for a really long time. Now, here's what's also fascinating for me as a person who plans interventions. The first three things happen before they ever meet a transplant person at all. So learning about transplant as an option, calling to begin evaluation, and mailing a medical packet is happening in your families, at home, or in dialysis centers. So these three things, we're assuming that people outside of transplant are getting it done. So we wanted to learn a little bit about this. So in 2004, I started to track white and black patients who presented at our transplant center, and we wanted to see who they were. We wanted to look at both non-modifiable and modifiable characteristics about where they started, and we wanted to follow them to see ultimately what happened and whether they got transplants or not. So we found that at the end of the day, of these almost 700 people, very few actually received a deceased or a living donor kidney transplant, so 27% and 18%. And many fewer black patients received a living donor kidney transplant compared to whites. So only 9% of the patients that we had on our list ultimately received a living donor kidney transplant. So what was interesting to us is, could we do anything to help? Could we predict from the beginning what was going to happen, and would there be any way we could help the process happen? And the good news was that the patients who on day one walked into our transplant center reporting to us that they had received better education from community nephrologists or in their dialysis centers, meaning hours of basically conversation and education. It was about hours and time with different people. People who walked in more knowledgeable about the facts of transplant and walked in more motivated to pursue deceased or living donor kidney transplant were two to three times more likely to complete evaluation successfully and receive living donor kidney transplant 6 years later. So on day one, their knowledge. On day one, their level of motivation. On day one, what had happened prior to us predicted what happened 6 years later. And also from a sense of being alive, patients have the advantages of transplants. Why this is interesting to me is that these things are things that we can, at a low cost, and as people who plan motivational interventions, do something about. It's not like we can say African Americans are less likely and we don't know why, or we can't do anything about them. Now let's go back to why I care a lot about this. So this is the 5-year life expectancy for people living life on dialysis or living life with a deceased or living donor transplant. So what I see is, let's think about those 6 years. So during those 6 years, people were either waiting for a deceased donor transplant, maybe they were getting a living donor transplant. But if you think about the absence of people on the yellow bar here, so 36% of people are alive on dialysis after 5 years. What we do educationally and motivationally reaching them is going to make the difference between whether they join on these blue or green bars or whether they do not. So a lot of my research stems from what can we be doing in this 5-year window that we have with them. And I'm not the only one who agrees. CMS, Medicare, has formal conditions for coverage that for dialysis centers, that remember the 70% of patients that are on dialysis in the country, to receive funding to fund these patients' care, the dialysis centers must provide evidence of transplant education, they must track patients' transplant referrals and their status on the waiting list, and they must communicate with transplant facilities regarding patient status annually and when there's a change in transplant status. So you think, great, there's regulations, it's gonna be happening, education's gonna happen, it's all good. Okay. So let me show you the universe of dialysis and transplant in the United States. So the green, this is the Christmas map. Mm-hmm. So the green dots are the 6,000 dialysis centers in the country taking care of these patients. And the red stars are the 250 transplant centers that we have around the country. So I think two things when I see this visually. The first thing I think is, think how much variation in care there is in the 6,000 dialysis centers. But then I also think, what about the patients in this center who are very far from a transplant center? What about the patients here who have 10 centers nearby? What about the patients in California? There's difference in waiting times on the coast versus in the middle. So there's a lot going on here from a care map standpoint, which is what this means to me, that I think is really interesting to investigate. And we didn't know a lot about what was going on. So I was able to go out and actually survey providers in almost over 1,000 dialysis centers. And the idea was, okay, you have these mandates. You're supposed to be doing this. What are your attitudes about educating about transplant? Maybe you don't want to do this because it's going to take patients out of dialysis and from the profit of dialysis into transplant. Maybe you like it. Now, are you prepared as an educator to be able to educate? And what are you actually doing on a day-to-day basis? No one had ever asked this before. So here's what's shocking. So let's go back for a second. 1,544 dialysis providers in 1,000 dialysis centers, 20% of the dialysis centers in the country, 55% reported that they were dissatisfied with currently available transplant education materials. 53% were not confident in their ability to be a transplant educator, and 27% perceived communication between dialysis and transplant centers to be poor. So we have a problem in care, yeah.
A dialysis provider, are these physicians?
These are the people providing, interesting question. Physicians recommend that people get transplants, but the people responsible in general are social workers and a care team with multiple people. So this is predominantly social workers and nurses.
Who work at dialysis.
Correct, yes. That this is their task. And doctors can definitely add to it and advocate for it. But these are the people that fill out the forms.
Now, of course, a dialysis patient's a source of revenue for dialysis center.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how intensely do they, are they encouraged to recruit
to go forward? It's a good question. You're setting up my next slides. Thank you very much. All right. So the first, stay tuned. So the first point is this: these are the providers. These are not their patients. Okay. So do the providers know about transplant? So we asked them 16 questions. They were only able to get 42% of the questions correct themselves, the healthcare providers, including the one that makes me smile and feel chagrin at the same time. Dialysis is equivalent to the work of 10 to 15% of one functioning kidney. That is what is so. Only 23% of people knew that about their own treatment. They don't even know that it isn't equivalent to a functioning kidney. So dialysis providers cannot even compare and contrast dialysis against transplant. Then we said, well, what are you doing? And this, I believe, is the slide that Martin would like me to speak to. So this is what across these 1,000 centers, they're orally recommending patients learn more about transplant themselves and that they be evaluated if they're interested. So at this time, I would like to conduct transplant education for all of you. I would like you to consider the option of transplant. It is available to you. If you'd like to learn more, good luck with that, and you should get evaluated if you want to. That is how, at the moment, across the country, people are honoring the conditions for coverage. Now, what we would all like would be that there was a detailed discussion about the advantages and risks, and they make an informed choice. It's only happening in 21% of the centers. So the question was, and for people, this is a man on dialysis speaking to his care team, and how could we help dialysis providers better educate about transplant? They're obviously not prepared. They're vulnerable about it. Here's the other part. I have a lot of compassion for them because they were never trained in transplant. So these are dialysis providers trained to provide dialysis care, and now we want them to educate about transplant, and they never got that information anyway. So we partnered up with a lot of different ESRD networks, which are the networks that are quality improvement networks across the country responsible for ensuring that these conditions for coverage are met. And we said we want to do a big national quality improvement initiative. We were able to touch 150,000 patients. And we brought in dialysis providers to hotel ballrooms, to community rooms, anywhere we could, to prepare the providers to better educate their own patients about transplant. It wasn't about me educating. It was about empowering the dialysis community to educate their own patients. So it was very simple what we did. We brought them together and we had them start talking to one another. Peer-to-peer, the dialysis providers were talking about what barriers to transplant education were they seeing, what approaches might help. People were sharing their expertise with how they overcame their own barriers with each other. We then gave a presentation of videos, exercises, and trainings demonstrating how to use Explore Transplant with patients. And people learned how to use the program that I've developed that I'll tell you about in a second, and got to ask a lot of questions. We brought in an expert panel of all of the transplant centers in that area so that the people could meet them, they could answer the basic questions, they could answer the specific questions that transplant center has. Sometimes the transplant center people were sitting there with the patient's information, they'd say, what's so with this patient? And they would be comparing information. The goal was that the people could leave understanding how to talk about both the good and the bad of transplant, the costs. People are often concerned about the costs. And finally, they walked out of the room with bags of education in English and Spanish that included a video program and all of these resources. At the bottom, they included posters about the opportunity for transplant for their patients, and they even had little postcards that said, are you interested in transplant? Want to learn more? See Amy. And the patients could respond if they were interested. So the whole idea was to increase the visibility of transplant as a treatment option. And all of this started because I actually developed a program called Explore Transplant that was based on the trans-theoretical model. That was a guided program where patients think about what's important to them. They think about the risks and benefits of being a recipient, also involving somebody else, and at the end they decide what they want to do. And the thing that's also great about the program was that the program also invited the family to learn more, and there were things the family could do to support the patient, including being a living donor for them. So this is like a CAN program. And we conducted a randomized controlled trial, and what we found was that when the patients received Explore Transplant, they were able to have significantly improved transplant knowledge. They were more likely to be looking for a living donor 1 month later. They were more likely to report that they were making an informed decision 1 month later. But what's exciting, which had this program go at the level of 150,000 patients, was that we actually showed that 1 to 2 years later, people who had received Explore Transplant were more likely to go forward for evaluation. So this was very exciting for the transplant community and for my life. And here's what we found. So there were a couple goals. So I want you to think about, this is a group of people who came to one of the trainings, actually in California, and we gave them their own education and all of these bags of education. What if every one of these people had the ability now to have effective conversations with patients? What could be possible, right? That was the question. Would they even play with us? And to go back to your point, maybe they weren't going to buy in. Maybe there was no point in doing all of this. The other part was that we wanted to have patients go home and to share this with their extended family. A lot of the difficulty with transplant is you can't reach the extended family and the potential living donors. So the goal was to send home the video, have people be engaged, learn together. So we've done 65 of these trainings across the country in 2,000 dialysis centers with 2,500 providers. And we have more scheduled for this year. This is where the nonprofit comes in. So this became so big that the exciting part is that that we were able to do this, and transplant centers were calling and saying, how can we do this as well? So I have gone everywhere, including, I'm trying to think, Montana. I was in Missoula, Montana. I was also in Hawaii because I had to go. So it was really wonderful to see all the healthcare providers across the country and to realize you're in these different locations and they're the same, but everything is different. So it was really exciting. And I want to show you what we found because I think this is really interesting from a dissemination and implementation side of things. So first I'm going to show you some data. I'm going to show you data in the reverse order, but I'm going to explain it. In 2009 and 2011, we did 11 trainings, and we trained 257 providers and have been able to follow them for many years. So I'll show you that. But also, we then were able to do this on a national level, and we have 1,544 providers trained. So I can show you that on a large scale. So I wanted to give you both cuts of this data so that you kind of could get a sense of what we saw. So from the national data, we looked at during the training, did they learn anything? Were they more confident educating? And at the end of it, what did they plan to do? Did they partner with us or did they quit on us? Did they say, thanks, no, we don't need that education, we're not going to partner with you? Then regionally, I want to look at what happened 6 months later. Did they actually do anything? And 2 years later, what happened with living donor kidney transplant rates? Okay, so this goes back to who was sitting in the chairs. So nurses, social workers, and dialysis techs are, and it's amazing, basically social workers tend to lead a group of transplant educators. They either do it by themselves or they lead all of these people to do it, is what seems to be the practice around the country. And this is what's cool, the before and after. So we asked them ahead of time, how knowledgeable did you feel? How confident do you feel? And are the materials available in your center excellent? You can tell you had a lot of variation in that. The good news is that people felt that it was improved at the end of the trainings. Then we looked at their knowledge. This makes me happy because they're out there educating patients. They were able to answer 92% of the questions correctly. So they could answer the questions that were going to come from their patients. Now, this goes back again to answer your question about did they buy in or is there a disincentive to educating? So we said, no pressure, you don't have to use this program at all. If this could serve you, use it. We don't know your care, you know, how you're taking care of your own patients. So we asked them, are you willing at the end of this training to determine which patients are on the waiting list, determine which patients are transplant candidates, hang up posters, share materials with your team that didn't come? And you see that people are, on average, willing to do that, walking out the door. 6 months later, we found that many people did. They definitely started figuring out who were candidates in their system. They started doing the small behaviors. Now, but what I care about is, are you going out there and educating with Explore Transplant? So the first part is they did buy in. And I was kind of shocked by this number, actually. So of the 1,544 dialysis providers, 75% walked out saying, I plan to educate at least 5 patients, which was great. Here's what we see, though. 6 months later, you only get a quarter of them doing it, a quarter to a third of them doing that. So what this means to me is it's an Explore Transplant intervention plus a lot of support. So what's happening in the nonprofit right now is we're coming in for a one-shot training, and the transplant centers are providing a lot of advocacy afterwards to say, how's it going? Can we help you? What can we do? So that wasn't part of this intervention, but definitely, as we all know from education interventions, a one-shot thing isn't always very successful. But what's intriguing to me is the fact that a quarter to a third of them actually played with me on this level. From a population-based standpoint, that touched a lot of patients. We gave out almost 15,000 packets of patient education as a part of this intervention. So that was pretty amazing. But now let's look at the smaller regional sample that we've been able to follow for a longer time. So we started off in, at the time, my home state in Missouri, and this was the network, the Heartland Kidney Network was one of the quality improvement networks serving those 4 states. So they let us in, and they provided care for 14,000 patients in 274 centers. And I want to introduce you to Marianne. So Marianne bought into this. So she's like, I've been waiting for this. Thank you for doing this. I'm totally going, like, I'm committed. You've got me. And I'm a data geek, and I'm even going to show you what I did. Okay? So she, 6 months later, she called us, and she said, here's what's going on. I gave this program to 14 people. 5 of them are currently being evaluated now. 2 of them have identified donors and been approved for transplant. 2 of them were on the deceased donor list, but when I showed them the living donor side, they figured out that they would be okay doing that, and now they've gotten a living donor transplant, and 1 person went forward and was medically ruled out. So educated 14, 10 of them actually began exploring the option of transplant for themselves. Now, Marianne is a unique and special person that we're not assuming is in every dialysis center in the country, but what's fascinating from a data standpoint is that providers who reported educating at least 5 patients using Explore Transplant were significantly more likely to have at least 1 living donor transplant in the 2 years following. And centers in urban areas, which meant that they were near transplant centers, so dialysis centers near transplant centers, were the other thing. It wasn't about race. It wasn't about the fact that all of their patients were Black. It was about the fact that their provider bought into us.
So what did you adjust for?
We adjusted for a lot of things. So all of these things were adjusted for in the model. So
I was a statistician on that. I could talk details with you. Those would be, the list here are the variables that were univariately significant when we went through, and then the what we're calling adjusted for would be the ones that were multivariately significant afterwards. But we started out with a long list, and I would be happy to follow up with
you. Yeah. So we're intrigued. Now, do I think that this is the end-all, be-all analysis? I don't. We actually just submitted an R21 to look at national data and look at the patients that we have and look at trends in education and how it matters. But this was like some preliminarily interesting findings. So now where are we with this? So as I've said, we want to really look to see if we can look at trends in education, which is modifiable. We want to look at when transplant education fails. So my belief as a person doing dissemination and implementation work is that it's just as interesting when you go and you're positive and you get them all excited and they don't use it at all, right? What were characteristics of the facilities, the areas, the patients in those facilities? Why is it not working? There's a lot of need for a Spanish-speaking program as people are requesting across the country. Now, one of the things we're also doing is we're saying maybe we shouldn't use the dialysis providers at all. So if only a third of them will ultimately educate 5 patients, even after a quality improvement organization champions it and a group gives them free education and tries to excite them and train them, maybe we should skip them. If they partner with us, great, but maybe they wouldn't. So the other model that we're testing is a model that's used by health insurance companies. And the idea is you look for patients with ICD-9 codes that are kidney failure related, and then you actually go and do phone intervention with them using a case manager or mailing them information or things like that. So we now are beginning a study to look at reaching the patients directly, the dialysis patients, and supplementing what is happening in the dialysis center, not just assuming that the dialysis provider is 100% in our camp. So we'll be working on that in the next few years.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
It's related, I think, to what Martin said a little bit, but so do you have any idea if the nephrologists at the site is influential because you're working directly with everyone else, it sounds like, but
right.
What are you finding out about them?
I find the nephrologists are powerful, but don't spend a lot of time with the patients in dialysis centers, is what the experience across the country is. So it's not that you don't trust the nephrologist, but they say you should think about this. And then there's a team that's actually educating or not that follows up with the nephrologist. I found that nephrologists who aren't in support of transplant are the most problematic, if that makes sense. If they're tolerating it, it's fine. I don't know if this rings. Some of our social workers have said, I can't even educate them unless my nephrologist says it's okay. So, which is inconsistent with the conditions.
So, Amy, thinking about where financial incentives align with education, from the health insurer's perspective, is it more expensive to have a patient chronically on dialysis or to transplant them? If you take like a 10-year time horizon.
There's a rule of thumb that they talk about in the policy literature that says for every 5 people who you can get to transplant, you save the country $1 million compared to lifetime dialysis. So if, you know, in this intervention, that was education. So
So health insurance companies should pay you for this.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So the idea would be... So the idea would be if we could figure out the dials, right, as a researcher and kind of look at how we would do this or how we wouldn't do this. So Anna Michelle is sitting in the back and is working hard on this. And basically where we are now is the design phase. But one of the things that we're... Hello? In the design phase, what we're looking at is taking the same program that we gave to the dialysis providers and repackaging it in pieces. The good news is that the videos are guided, so the patient can watch those at home. And then mailing them a series of things, texting them, doing things that were lower cost in one of the arms, but then in the other arm, have a case manager educator actually do the guided program. Because both of these are the ways it gets done in health insurance companies. And then the idea is, if we're working with the patients that are getting left out in dialysis centers, does this make any difference?
Can you mute your phone?
Yeah.
I can't cut them.
All right.
Hi, is somebody on the line? That might be a wrong number.
What's more?
So
it's like
a test. You're developing this as our
tool. No, we already have a HRSA grant for this for the next 3 years. So we're just at the beginning stages, though. So if people this is really exciting to them, we would love to have people.
Do you have a health plan partner?
We don't. No, let me explain. So we're doing this because this grant was funded when I used to live in another state. We're working in Missouri with a group that's working with the lower income population who handles their medication and supplements it. The goal, though, would be that we could figure this out and then find a health partner or write another grant to do this. My feeling right now is the debate has been, well, can you actually send the education home and do the patients watch it and do they participate and do they learn and all of those things, right? So we don't know any of these questions yet. So, but the goal ultimately would be to set this up in a way that it could be taken over by a health insurance partner. Yes.
So it would be nice to structure incentives in some way that they would be motivated, as motivated as possible to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Of course, I guess one of the problems is that Medicare is paying for a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But it strikes me that, you know, that one could imagine transparency might help. Mm-hmm. If, for example, they were publicly available data with appropriate adjustments on the rate at which various dialysis centers succeed in getting their patients to transplant. And if that were known, it might affect their business.
Yes. CMS has actually approached me about impact, like taking the auditing way that they're doing auditing and modifying it to catch centers that are not actually doing risk-benefit education. So that's a part of the... There's a sense now, and skipping to the end of the slide, there's a lot of policy implications to this work. And so I definitely love to be working with policy people. I'm working with some policy people at WashU, but I think that it's important, yeah.
I mean, along those lines, what are some of the opportunities if you have truly accountable care organizations? I mean, if you have the same organization, right, that has both the transplant center and the dialysis, I mean, that you have $1 million for every five patients. I mean, is there some way that, you know, that savings could be shared by the people implementing that? Mm-hmm.
Yes, totally. Well, the interesting thing about transplant and kidney disease in general is it's the first one that we've been tracking the data for everything. So we have all of the data. We have great databases. So I'm working with the people who do the dialysis data, so we're able to merge this in, like this education data, for the first time. So it'll be interesting. Other great comments? Shall I continue? Yes. Another one.
I often ask the question in these forums, like, what happens in other parts of the world that tend to consider themselves, you know, civilized or semi-civilized? Like, how do the rates of, you know, transplant and everything, you know, compare in other places, and specifically then, you know, getting... And so you can either address that or not, but like, what are the chances of getting an opt-out strategy? I used to think about it as more of the, you know, the cadaveric donors, like, you know, if I am in the ICU or whatever, that becomes an opt-out thing. Mm-hmm. But you potentially, you know, could sort of force the issue, you know, once you're signed up for dialysis and we're going to start paying for that, you're going to be educated and, like, get all this stuff.
Totally.
I mean, like, without, you know, and you have to actively kind of sign away to get off that treadmill.
Yes.
How difficult is that here?
Okay, so there are about 6 questions in that. Let me address the first one. So Ping Sing has just arrived, just knowing that you would ask this, from Singapore, to spend 6 weeks with me to figure out how to make education, you know, happen. So we can actually let you do you want to say anything about any of this from a Singapore standpoint?
For Singapore, for dialysis, I mean, it's the same, but we don't provide education from the dialysis center. It's physician-driven, so it's for the physician to initiate the topic to the patients and then make a referral to the transplant coordinator for the coordinator to stand, to arrange an appointment for patients and families to come and spend a 3 hours counseling and provide education.
So they come to you for the education.
Yes.
So again, look at all the barriers that are going to show up there, right? So I don't know I don't know a lot of the global data. Can you speak to this, Keith?
So one thing, I'm pretty certain for Singapore and some countries. So here in the United States, on your driver's license, you can opt and say, you know, if I die by organ. In Singapore, you have to opt out.
Right.
So in some countries, you have to opt out for those things. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it stood for a while, at least. My understanding of Singapore was the more ambulatory you were and the more active you were in doing things, the less you had to pay for dialysis yourself. So the Kidney Foundation was supplementing, or at least supplements from the Kidney Foundation, they would actually give you more money if you're doing more and moving, and so that would at least help with dialysis and moving people toward transplantation. I think the one major difference we have here compared to most of the world, although it's not like the transplant rates are great around the world, after 30 months after you get a transplant, Medicare no longer covers dialysis. So then it goes back to a carrier to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the savings... So for most insurance carriers, after, I think they have 24 months or 30 months where they cover them, and then you go on to Medicare. So getting someone onto a transplant, for system-wide, it's a big savings, but it's a big disconnect between federal dollars and health insurance dollars. And so that becomes the main barrier in trying to figure the balance out between where the wins are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the dialysis providers who are working with the low SES patients. They feel very skeptical to refer them in for transplant, even though it could give them a longer life, because if it's financially problematic for them and they wouldn't do their immunosuppressant drug. So there's a lot of ethical debate about should you be getting them a transplant if they're going to lose it due to finances, and you know, and how does this affect people? So all of that is going on as a part of this.
So another, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
So if you had to pay several thousand dollars a year for your transplant drug, and you no longer have insurance coverage, government says, well, you just lose your kidney, but if you go back on dialysis for $60,000 a year, we'll gladly take you back and dialyze you, but we're not going to pay the few thousand dollars you need to stay off of dialysis with medication.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but what I appreciate about where you are is there's definitely an economic case to be made. Education is cheap. So as I've been doing this, you know, I'm just there. The data hasn't been there. My data is the first data that is in any way larger, and what needs to be done next. There's a lot of, I would definitely love partners if anybody, that's their kind of thing. Okay, so we're actually going to work in the case management model, and then, but we're also going to go back into the transplant center. So we've been out in the universe, now we're coming back in. And the key here is we talked about the first parts and how we're really trying to help people begin evaluation. And then the second part of this is that people, we still have to help them make it through to transplant, right? So we get them in and then they drop out, right? Patients drop out or they don't pursue living donor transplant. They don't get a transplant. So I want to show you something interesting. And so I've been working in the African American community for many years because that was our largest community in St. Louis. I'm really excited to broaden this. But one of the things that we found was that across the country, African Americans are 3.4 times more likely to have kidney failure, but still are receiving less kidney transplants, particularly living donor transplants. So there's many levels from an intervention of why are the African American patients not going forward for living donor transplant and their community members not donating to them. So, and this is true in every transplant center in the US, which I think is amazing. And at UCLA, I just want to show you one piece of data that we all get up in arms about. So 1,453 patients presented for evaluation in 2013. And they were able to get 265 total kidney transplants. People are waiting on the list, things like that. 110 of them were living donor transplants. But for African Americans, which are about a quarter to a third of the people who are presenting, they received only 11% of the transplants here and only 4.5% of the living donor transplants, which means 5 living donor transplants happened in Los Angeles for African American patients in 13. I'm like, we're about at zero here. What else could we be doing? How could we be helping? So Crystal, who's back here waving, is champion. She's going to fix this for me. Thank you. Thanks, Crystal. And she's going to do this through an amazing expert system, individually tailored education and coaching program that she's going to run with her team.
I know that
guy. Yes. So this, oh, you know Will? Yeah. So this program, so I've never developed a computerized expert system before. We now have a program called Your Path to Transplant, which, if you think about explore transplant, that's just like learn. Your path is your individual path, right? Amy's path to transplant. So an expert system, if you don't know what one of these is basically a big database of every possible thing a patient may or may not know, their fears, responses to their fears, benefits, risks, everything. And the idea is you set up a survey, and based on how the patients answer, they get an individually tailored report. There are a few cool things about this. One is that it's about where you are today, so it allows for change. You could go back in a few months and say, you know what, Amy, it seems like you're getting a little smarter, or you're getting a little more freaked out about this. It also is unique to me. It honors that I might be really hungry for a deceased donor transplant and really scared about a living donor transplant, and we can deal with that too. So we've been designing that. It was a horrible experience and very professionally rewarding at the end. But what I would say that's exciting now is we get to launch it and we get to see how patients respond. And we're going to really look at, are they shifting over time as they move through transplant evaluation in their knowledge, in their readiness to pursue living donation, and what they're planning on doing, and are they more successful at not dropping out and receiving living donor transplants? So we're following 930 people. We're actually intervening at 4 time points, including at the transplant evaluation day itself, and then by phone at 3 other time points. We get to look at all of that. And then we follow them on medical record review. So imagine you get these in the mail, you know, Amy's unique report, and then you get a coach where the coach is actually looking at what I don't know, what I'm scared of, what small action I'm willing to do and how I could best do this. The coach is celebrating small successes and comparing me to see how I'm changing. So the coach is rooting for the patient. The other part that I'm also really excited about this study is that the feeling that I have is that we sit here and we say, well, let's give them more knowledge and more motivation. That'll fix everything. And my feeling is there are a lot of things going on in a person's life that could derail them, even if they were excellently educated and very motivated. And from a disparity standpoint, no one has ever measured what these are and looked at which ones really matter over time for transplant. So we are developing both a measure of derailers and also exploring what derailers really matter. And we're measuring all of these things over time to see if what matters when they walk in. And wow, a really motivated person who really wants a living donor transplant who doesn't feel safe in their neighborhood ultimately doesn't make it through. And then I think that it breaks open what we can do from a community level after that. So I'm excited by this. I also think what's great about having this computer program, now that we've done the blood, sweat, and tears of it, is we can take it anywhere and test it out. Could we put this on the web? Could we take it to the transplant center and have it supplement what the conversations are being? Could we go to dialysis centers and present this? Could we, so all of the idea of you have a computer, an individually tailored computer program, and we work out the kinks in this first trial, and then we say, how could this be brought to patients? Okay, so let me get to something else. So last piece before I lose you guys is I want to talk about the status quo in education. So here's what I think is what is so, okay? Due to the need for living donors, educational initiatives will launch, but they may not truly increase informed decision-making or be maximally effective. They just need them. So we're going to launch things. Then there's some researchers who get money. We'll get a little bit of money, and we'll try something. And we may end up figuring out what will work, but it'll take a long time. The other part is a lot of healthcare professionals who are talking to all of these patients across the country really don't know how to have effective conversations, and more patients will die while we learn, especially minorities. So the idea is, and this is what brought me to UCLA, is could we set up a Center for Transplant Education and Living Donation, a think tank? And everyone freaks out about the word center, and I've heard there's all this politicalness about this. So just interact with this as an idea, not a formal center. And so the idea home. Is what?
A home.
A home, a friendly home. Not a, yes, exactly. So here's what I want to say to kind of, like, could we create a center with a mission to really explore these issues with all of the expertise of people in here? And could the center be doing everything from designing education to working on policy to doing secondary data analysis to working with health insurance companies to training providers and disseminating best practices across the country? So that's kind of where I'm here. And actually, I was able to get $1 million from the One Legacy, which is our organ procurement organization, to begin the money for this center. So this is something that brought me here. I'm excited, and it needs friends. So the thing that I wanted just to leave you with is if any of these things resonate for you and you could say, hey, I could help you out in this way, I would be very grateful and be open for even things outside of these bullets. But if you'd be a friend of the center, that would be amazing. If you could provide coaching on the direction of the center and how it could fit into established research collaborations that are already here that I don't know about because I'm new, I would be grateful. If you could expand or source your own research in some way. So if some of these issues, if transplant is something you go, hey, that could align with some of the big themes that I work on in my research, I'd be totally open for partners like that. People have come to me. What's been great is people keep expanding ideas on how transplant patients could be studied. So because I'm working in nephrology and I have access to the databases, we can look at other issues that maybe my center work isn't focused on, but other people have, you know, adherence issues, measure development, cultural issues, spirituality, mHealth. And then finally, I've already seen people are bringing graduate students, MDs, and PhDs to me because they're interested in working on these kind of areas, and I'm totally welcome to that. So I just wanted to kind of say, I exist on the 12th floor, remember? and so if any of these things would support what you're doing, I'd really appreciate it.
Cool.
any questions or anything?
So Amy, I'm sure you've thought about this. I had, you know, my N of one experience trying to get a patient to a living donor transplant, mm-hmm. and somebody who's been in my practice 21 years, and we were successful. But the biggest barrier at the end of the day was actually his family.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a kid who I just did a random creatinine on while he was a second year undergrad at UCLA, because he was eating like 200 Motrin a week. Mm. And I was just like, what? You know, and it just totally unrelated to the Motrin. He had mm-hmm. renal failure from IgE and nephropathy. Mm-hmm. And was in a big family, mm-hmm. had eight brothers and sisters, rural family from Bakersfield, mm-hmm. Vietnamese immigrants, mm-hmm. farming family.
Yep.
So I'm like, you're golden, right? You know, I mean, we will be able to find a great match. We have like all these siblings. And, you know, held a family meeting. Siblings and parents decided that whoever was the closest match would be it.
Mm-hmm.
The closest match was the favorite son.
Uh-huh.
So the parents jumped in and like, no way.
Okay.
You know, we're not going to have both of you die.
Yep.
You know,
right.
So, this is a low education family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just, in the end, we got the second best match in mm-hmm. the family, a sister, and, you know, they didn't care as much about the girls, so that was okay. But, and you know, they're both alive and well and healthy 15 years later. But it really struck home for me how much these living donor
yes.
situations are this kind of family social
yes.
network
yes.
decision. And I wonder with the education whether you have thought much about that.
I think it's crucially important. The educational initiatives that are working are involving the extended family. The people we can reach are the people who are in healthcare, right? So we get the recipients. We don't get their family because they're all not coming to the appointments, right? So what's interesting is it's so important to be studying all the living donors. One of the R01s that I put in January was to start to develop the first database of everybody presenting as a potential living donor here and following what happens over time. But I think all the people who didn't show up as living donors are also critical. So love the area, definitely would love to study the area. Absolutely.
But it seems like there's lots of things to study.
Yes, there.
So there should be about 18,000 people in Los Angeles County mm-hmm. who run dialysis.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So it's a lot of people to work with, but it's, as you would say, it's a manageable number.
Yes.
One can imagine getting everyone to where they need. Now, presumably, some of them are not appropriate. I
mean, right.
They're like,
correct.
They're these old people who shouldn't even be on dialysis.
Yes. They always say a third of the dialysis patients are probably transplant eligible, is the rule of thumb.
Right.
So of the, you know, the 70% of the 600,000, a third right. of those are. Yeah.
So, but it seems like there are lots, I mean, there's trust in the system.
Mm-hmm.
There's the way in which the system interacts with people. Makes it really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly populations you're talking about are populations which often have really bad experiences with medical systems.
Yes.
I'm struck by now your number, and I understand that some of it was the lack of living donors, that there were 25% of the people who presented,
mm-hmm.
but only 5%?
Five got a living donor transplant, yes.
But they were much earlier. They were 10% of the ones that got a kidney at all.
It was 5 in 300.
So 30 people received a deceased donor transplant, and 5 received a living donor transplant in the same year. That about 1,400 people came forward, and about 25 to 30% of them
yeah,
were African American.
Yeah, that's in 2013.
Yes. So
whereas the other groups that came forward,
many more. If you're a white person,
much more likely to get transplanted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
So, and is it well understood why that is?
No. So the thing that is cool about what Crystal's going to be doing
yeah.
is it's about really sitting and looking at both the modifiable and the non-modifiable and seeing what is going on. Because at the moment, our transplant center does not measure race. Mm. So we're actually at the level where we're uncovering a lot of the things. So I have a lot of great patients of a lot of different racial groups and am fighting hard to establish that you're measuring race from the beginning.
There was a recent large study by researchers out of Hopkins who showed that every single transplant center in the United States has a racial disparity in receipt of living donor transplant between white and black patients. Every single one, no one is exempt.
even among those presenting as candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every single one.
Yes. So don't you just want to figure it out? If we're at zero, I totally want to figure it out.
There's, you know, and this is debate in the literature right now. So some researchers are out there trying to isolate a race effect, and some people are saying if you just account for the socioeconomic stuff, the race effect goes away. Others are saying when you account for the socioeconomic stuff, there is still a race effect. And so I think this is a very live debate, and I hope that our team and then, you know, partners here can make a dent in that for sure.
And for the cascade of, right, that leads to these huge disparities and just the overall miserable break, right? This is a horrible situation.
Yes.
I mean, how many different parts of that cascade can we just eliminate the human element? I mean, it goes, you know, because whenever you get people involved, they tend to, you know, it's not their own fault, or they're not given the right information,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, physician practice, the art of medicine, that's just an excuse for, you know, ignoring data and trying to make up our own rules. And, you know, like, yeah, just go there. Like, the simpler you can make it, you know, to get everybody, I mean, like you say, the challenges of education, you know, are profound. And even if you streamline it completely and automate, make it so the norm is just,
yes.
Guess what? You know, when you go in to see that, I haven't done this since residency, but, you know, look, you're probably a year or two away from now that we're going to start talking about getting you on dialysis. I mean, the conversation about transplant was, I mean, basically non-existent, at least, right. You know, in the Bronx where I was.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it looks like, you know, for other nephrology practices, but you know, if you were lucky enough to have that, like, you know, you should get your fistula. These were the options.
Right.
It was
right.
Not
you were dealing with survival. Like, dealing with survival.
The default should be you should be thinking about transplant now. I mean, mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm not going to pay you. I'm Medicare. You are not going to get paid unless you've documented that you've initiated that conversation. I mean. Mm-hmm.
You might want to help me with my economics.
There's so much money to be had. $1 million every five? That is, well, there's nothing else like it. I mean,
I'm giving you a rule of thumb, but yes.
CMS has a form.
Most expensive thing.
CMS has a form called 2728, sort of. It's a mandated form. You have to give it within 45 days of people coming into dialysis. There's a question. It's number 26. It says, have you informed this patient about transplant? It uses the word inform. Now, if you dig up some of the conditions for care, maybe they elaborate on a little bit of what that is, but the question reads, this is the one question
that
reads, have you been informed? And you can even say yes.
And you can check that off.
You can say yes, or you can say no. And if you say no, there's maybe five reasons that you've determined. They're psychologically unfit, they're medically unfit, all mm-hmm. these other things. We found in regional data, and other researchers have found in national data, that patients, right. So in the first place, one that Amy talked about, we just wrote an R01 trying to figure out, okay, that's totally inadequate. It's an ambiguous question. Doesn't reveal anything. We know a lot more about the details about education and what happens. But on top of that, people in nonprofit dialysis centers, providers in nonprofit dialysis centers are more likely to even do that part of it versus for-profit. And that's a very live debate in the literature right now, too, where major dialysis chains will come back and then actually, you know, write in these editorials, no, that's not true. That's not true about us, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're doing the right things. Yeah.
Now, I understand you have a large interest in black-white disparities, which is a really important issue. You're also in Southern California, where
absolutely.
We have a large Latino population mm-hmm. and
yes.
a large undocumented population. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So I'm working in the hospital at the moment, and I have a patient in the hospital who's a man in his early 20s who's lived here for 15 years, and he's got end-stage liver disease. Mm-hmm. I know it's different. Mm-hmm. And basically, the word was, well, he's undocumented, so he can't get a liver. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, we got to figure this out.
Yes, maybe, I agree.
And maybe we can even go to the hospital and say, hey, come on, he's been our patient for 15 years. Mm-hmm. Well, people say, oh, no, can't do it. Anyway, so I run into the main transplant guy in the elevator, and I mm-hmm. say, is it true that undocumented people can't get a liver? He said, no.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Just
talking about the barriers to getting this communicated and dealt with. Yep. But it seems like it's an important area.
I totally agree. I'm excited. This is the first, why I'm so excited to be here, because you have every race in one center.
Yeah.
Normally you have a couple in a regional area where those communities have settled. This is a place where we could do interventions across races and be looking at that and changing dials to see what is working and if it's different or the same. And so I'm excited. I want to definitely be expanding into the Latino community. St. Louis didn't have a large population of Latinos, so I was not able to study. Yes.
Have you tried to connect the stuff you're doing with this MEI, Medical Education Institute?
Uh-huh. I know about them, yes.
They seem to be really powerful.
That'd be great. I'd love to connect with, I'd love to know about everything, figure out how what we're doing could help or, you know, not step on toes if there's turf already taken. So I don't know them, but bottom line is I exist. I'm thrilled to be invited. Please come visit me and email me and send me your people, and I would love to figure these questions out. I'll be working on these questions for the rest of my life. Yes.